Hi, I'm Raoul Pal, co-founder and CEO of Real Vision. Thank you so much for listening to the Real Vision podcast. At Real Vision, we pride ourselves in providing the best in-depth expert analysis available to help you understand the complex world of finance, business, and the global economy. If you like what you hear, I hope you'll accept my invitation to try Real Vision Plus for 30 days for just $1. Visit realvisionpodcast.com today and join us as we navigate the financial world together. Cheers.
All right, welcome to this week's episode of The Knock-On Effect. I'm Alex Rosenberg, joined here by Jake Merle. Jake, I would say, is almost the Chris Novoselic of Real Vision. You know, the bass player from the Nirvana.
Whatever you say, Alex. Yeah, it's great to be here.
He's kind of behind the scenes of a lot of our hit shows, and working here as an editor, and we're going to talk a bit about a conversation that I had on Twitter, a bit of a Twitter battle, and Jake's views on it. So it should be fun.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Let's do it.
All right. So on the weekend, I don't know why I even did this, much less I'm talking about it now. But I saw a tweet from most people know that account Pomp. What's his first name? His handle is a.
His first name isn't crypto.
No, his handle is A. Pompliano, and he's a founder and partner at Morgan Creek Digital. And he tweeted something that just got my Irish up a bit. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that anymore, but he said, and I'm just quoting here the original tweet, "Inflation is the greatest cause of income inequality in the modern world. Bitcoin provides an alternative deflationary monetary system. Slowly, people will opt out of the legacy system and opt into the new one. Welcome to a better world." And listen, I used to get in more Twitter spats, and now I think I've matured as a man and as a tweeter. But this I responded. I just said, you know, this gets it exactly wrong. Inflation hurts those who have money now. And you know, if you want the whole gory argument, you can check out my mentions. But basically, my Twitter handle, by the way, is @AcesRose. You know, but he responded, you know, that's incorrect. Inflation steals from the poor who are all cash and enriches the rich since real asset prices rise. And I responded, well, the poor don't have cash. That's actually what makes them poor. And, you know, the argument kind of continued very civilly, I will say, with Pomp and with some other people. There's one, I want to know your views on it, Jake, but there's one tweet I just have to mention from someone named Alex Allegro, @OneAllegro, who actually deleted this tweet. But what he said first was, you know, I said that, you know, the poor may have money in cash, but they just don't have much cash. Inflation hurts those who have money now, basically. And he said, what you're saying, I'm quoting here, what you're saying sounds like prices of housing is crashing. Oh, that's great for me. I'm homeless, so I'm not losing money. And he added, LOL, which I think he actually provided a really good example of why I'm right. Because the point is, I'm not saying that a housing crash is good, just as I'm not saying that inflation is good necessarily. All I'm saying is that just as a housing crash hardly hurts a homeless person at all, but is really horrifying for someone who owns a house, it's the same thing with inflation. It hardly hurts those who don't have money. It actually might help those who take out loans, but that's another story. But it's very bad for those who have a ton of money. Anyway, that's my argument, and the reason we're doing this podcast is because Jake walked in on Monday morning and said, "Oh, I saw your little Twitter fight." He's like, "You're right, but you're also wrong," and that intrigued me. And we haven't actually had a chance before now to talk about this. So Jake, I'll let you. I am very curious your perspective on this.
Yeah, Alex. So I think you're absolutely right that inflation is a wealth transfer from people with money. But I think it's the wealth transfers to people with money to people who are spending that newly created money. I think of it as monetary inflation. So once that money is created through lending and credit through commercial banks and the fractional reserve banking system, where does it go? Who spends it? What do they spend it on? Do they not spend it at all? Then you get, you know, the traditional things like consumer price inflation or asset price inflation, deflation. And this is all a function of, you know, the business cycle and demographics, interest rates. But I think what Alex wants to talk about is that inflation affects rich people more than it affects poor people. And that's kind of like the crux of like the argument. And while by definition, I think this is true because rich people have more money than poor people, as Alex just kind of said with that that home example that that he had on Twitter. But inflation basically destroys the value of that money. Therefore, it's logical to think that inflation is worse for rich people. While I think that makes sense, in my opinion, it in reality, it doesn't really work out that way. So through the rich people avoid this taxation by using their capital to buy assets, mm-hmm. and that basically inflation forces them into those assets, and that provides them a real yield as the assets rise faster than the CPI. I know that Alex will argue that inflation forces these rich people to lend their money out to poor people, but I disagree, and I think they would just rather buy the assets or lend it out to other rich people who then would buy assets. And by the way, when I say rich people, I mean, you know, wealthy individuals, financial institutions and intermediaries, asset allocators and banks who are all involved in this process. But as Alex rightly points out on his Twitter storm and in his article, inflation affects rich people tremendously, but they still get that real yield because they're kind of, you know, not cheating the system, but in a little way, they're avoiding that taxation that poor people just can't seem to avoid. And so they can also borrow more money to then buy assets and get that real yield. So that helps them avoid inflation. On the other hand, poor people see their cost of living rise dramatically. Rich people do as well, but it affects their marginal propensity to consume much more than rich people. Like, for example, let's say you have someone in their bank account who has $1 million and $100,000 gets wiped out, 10%. Yeah, that sucks. That person's going to be really, really mad, and it's terrible, and $100,000 nominally is a lot of money. But if you have someone whose bank account is, let's say, $10,000 and they get $1,000 wiped out, 10%, you know, that's going to affect their spending, their consumer patterns. That's really going to affect their lifestyle. It really hits home and it really hurts them. And so I think that spread, that delta of, you know, not just looking at it nominally or thinking about it logically, but just thinking about it, how it affects that person, I think it hurts poor people more than it hurts rich people. At the same time, they take on debt not to invest, but to consume. And the spread they have on their credit cards is higher than the rate of inflation. So they are paying that real yield, while on the other hand, rich people are receiving that real yield through assets.
Right. But even if their cost of living increases, then their salaries are also rising. I mean, that's what inflation is. It's costs rise, wages rise. I mean, everything rises. And this is something, by the way, that it was very interesting, almost sociologically. People's on Twitter were saying, oh, you know, people are still making $15 an hour, still making the same wage. And even one person even tweeted at me the chart of real wages from Fred, and I was like, yeah, see how the line is going up? I mean, it's not exactly skyrocketing, but that's after, you know, I was like, okay, maybe I got a little angry, and I was tweeting while walking. You know, I was walking with Michelle, and she was like steering me through the intersections, like, oh, step up, oh, watch out, there's a car, because I was anyway. But I was maybe getting a little mad, but I was like, you know, that's after inflation, right? So I guess the point I would respond with is that. Hey, and you know, their cost of living is rising, their wages are rising. They're not necessarily doing better with inflation, but they're you know, breaking even as far as their standard of living goes.
You know, I agree. That's what, you know, the data says, and that's accurate. And if you just think about wage push and inflation, that's definitionally correct as well. And you could look at correlations between wages and the CPI, and you're absolutely right. But what that misses is almost not to say the other side of the balance sheet, but is their debt burden is just rising faster and faster, and that interest spread is rising faster than, let's say, that their purchasing power just staying flat. So in reality, as their debt burden gets worse, and let's say their purchasing power stays the same or rises constant, they're actually slowly deteriorating if you were to, I don't know, in my opinion, if you were to, you know, plot that out. But I did want to say one other thing about that. Not talking about manipulated data or data that's wrong, but if you were to really think about it, you know, wage data would never, ever be overstated because that would, you know, compress margins for corporations. So if anything, it's been not understated. I'm not saying it is at all, but I'm saying there's no reason to overstate it. But there is a big incentive to understate the CPI, which there's been many critiques in the past. And so you get into that and you start looking at the spreads, and it's just like it's not in the favor of the poor. But my main point to why I think, you know, poor people are getting crushed here is the debt burden and the mechanism of how money is created. I think it goes to rich people first and poor people second, and they're kind of getting shafted that way.
Okay, so let's go part by part here. So I mean, first of all, you know, you can have your quibbles with CPI, but CPI, PCE, there was that million good study, right? Didn't someone at Harvard do this million good study? I mean, like, only people who are like even tin hats at this point are saying there's inflation. Like, you have to be wearing like some very heavy material on your head to say that inflation is, you know, 5% or 10%. Or I mean, right? I mean, you go outside in the real world, it's like prices are seem to be rising at like a moderate pace year over year. It's not like you're paying way more for things. And I don't know. I don't think that data is understated. First of all,
I don't think it's understated either. But I'm saying there's no incentive for it, you know what I mean? There's no reason for it to be to overstated.
Okay, fine, fine. I don't know. Yeah, but getting back to you made a point about debt and about a debt burden rising. But just to put it in really simple terms, I mean, I want you to explain that point a little more, because of course if I borrowed $100, I'm supposed to pay back $110. If that $110, because inflation is really only worth $90, well, then I actually got a pretty good deal on my loan. So inflation is good for those who are taking out loans and bad for those who are holding loans waiting to get repaid. No, so I'm kind of confused about your debt burden point.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Inflation is to help debtors and not creditors, but I think that the yield the debtors have to pay is higher than what they actually have in inflation. So they actually have to pay out that real yield, while on the other hand, rich people can borrow and then use that money to invest at a higher yield, and they're receiving that real yield.
Yeah. So I guess if I was to summarize your overall point, is it having to do more with the mechanics of the monetary system as it exists today?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So that's maybe where pomp is coming in with the Twitter sphere fight about Bitcoin, because it is the mechanism. It is who gets that dollar first, who spends it first, what do they spend it on. That kind of is the core. I'm not sure. I think it's called the Cantillon effect. I know there's economists that call it that. That's one way to look at it.
So it's interesting. I mean, and part of just to broaden out the conversation a bit, you know, and you referred to an article I wrote. The part of the reason it made me so angry is because one of my criticisms of not of Bitcoin, but just of the idea of Bitcoin taking over the world and being, you know, what so much wealth is stored in and what so many transactions are done in. And it's a point kind of brought up by Mike Green, and he sort of talked about it with Tim Draper in a recent interview on Real Vision, which I'd encourage you to check out, realvision.com/knockoneffect, grab a 14-day free trial. All right, I got the plug in early this time. You know, he talked about the idea that there's a reason we have inflation, and if we have it, so of all the Bitcoin that's ever going to be mined, I don't know, 15 or 16 million are around, maybe 3 million have been lost, and, you know, another 2 million are going to be mined. I'm getting the number slightly wrong, but my point is that well over two-thirds of all the Bitcoin that will ever exist is already being held. And it's being held by rich people, by people who have some money to spare to buy a speculative asset. And I'm not trying to weigh in on whether that was a good bet or not. What I'm saying is that if Bitcoin does take over the world, that will lead to massive deflation, and all of the gains of the world's economy will adhere to the people who have already bought Bitcoin. So the reason that I was so made so angry by the tweet was, not only do I disagree with the idea that inflation is a cause of wealth inequality, I also think that if we do have a deflationary environment in which Bitcoin rules the roost, it will be a world of massive, massive, massive increases in inequality, with the gains going to people like Pomp, who might have bought Bitcoin early on.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting thought to think about. You know, his whole point is to, you know, reduce wealth inequality, yet Bitcoin right now kind of, it could potentially increase wealth inequality if Bitcoin were to become that global reserve asset. And again, how would that mechanism work, you know, to make sure that everyone has the right amount of, you know, Satoshis or whatever the proper term is.
Right. And with no government intermediating. And I mean, this is, I know some of you listening are going to disagree with this, but I like the fact that the government has a say. I mean, because the government is the people. Like, I like that as a member of our democracy, I have a say in what interest rates are, in how, in what the rate of inflation is, and how inequality spread. I mean, like just as a very simple thought experiment, if everyone woke up tomorrow and said, the Fed shouldn't target 2% inflation, they should target 2% deflation, and everyone voted for the president, for the members of Congress based on that belief, the target would go from 2% inflation to 2% deflation. It would happen. The president would take out Powell and put in, you know, Peter Schiff, or, you know, whatever name you want to put. So the fact that we have a say over our monetary policy, that's something we would totally lose with Bitcoin, and I don't think that's such a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, we could also tie that back to the inflation discussion we were just having, because essentially what you just said was that value is subjective. It's what mm-hmm. kind of what you think it is, or what you say it is, what everyone believes it is. Mm-hmm. And so going back to inflation, I think, demographics, and I know this is a little off gear from the Bitcoin, but demographics and the business cycle definitely dominate inflationary pressures and deflationary pressures over time. But I think in the grand scheme of things, you know, it's the equation M times V, you know, how much money is there and how much of it is moving around velocity. And so the velocity is based on confidence and trust, and it's objective based on the currency. And so I don't know, just my opinion is that over time, inflation is actually just a function of velocity, and which is actually just subjective value.
So I'm gonna put you on the spot here, because you and I do think differently about the world, which is always always interesting to me. So if I was made chairman of the Federal Reserve today, I wouldn't pursue radically different policies, you know, than you know current leadership, or really the last two chairs of the Fed. I don't think I think that this is we're sort of going in the right direction. You know, even though if we're moving in the wrong direction regarding inequality, you know, maybe there was a better way to do it than QE to save the economy. You know, I don't really think what the Fed's doing is massively wrong. I'm curious your perspective. Like, if you were made chair of the Fed, like, how would you like to see monetary policy done differently to make this world a better place?
Well, I mean, yes, we definitely think differently, to say the least. Yeah, I mean, I would let, you know, interest rates rip. I would just let them do what they're going to do, let the market do what it's going to do. Perhaps think about involving gold in some sort as a reference point or for stability regarding currencies for trade, which is a huge topic that everyone's talking about. If we just had stable currencies, we wouldn't have to deal with any of these issues. And, you know, we could just pony up some gold at the end of the year and call it
a year.
call it a day.
Sorry to interrupt, but how would that impact the landscape of wealth inequality, do you think?
I think, you have to get the money creation mechanism out of fewer hands and into, you know, a set system based on market forces. I think that's how you reduce wealth inequality. And also the basics, education. We've, you know, terrible education that's compared to other countries.
Certainly true.
You know, you have to teach a man to fish in order, you know, or else he's not going to get anywhere.
Oh, yeah. I think we would both agree that, like, monetary policy is not the main cause of wealth inequality. It's just...
There's many, many causes, I think, whether it's regulation, whether we have these duopolies or monopolies, mm-hmm. oligopolies here in the United States, across many different industries, you know, corporate profit margins at all-time high, whether it's cronyism with the government. There's a whole there's many different areas where wealth inequality is being affected right now.
So now how, just because we're down this rabbit hole, like, how do you think interest rates would, let's just take you know, the 2-year yield. I don't know what the 2-year yield is at today, but how do you think that level would change if the Fed basically, you know, just let banks lend each other at overnight deposits at whatever rate banks want to lend each other? Because personally, I don't think policy is so stimulative today. And for a lot of the crisis, I think actually rates would have been lower than had the Fed been involved. So
that's why they had to introduce the on excess reserves, the interest on excess reserves, because it forced the, you know, them to hold their capital rather than lend it. Then that would force down interest rates,
right?
Because there'd be an abundance of liquidity. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball to know how, you know, the 2-year would react in that environment. But you know, I think given normal market forces, interest rates should be much higher than they are now. That being said, I don't think that viewpoint is based on demographics. I think that viewpoint is based on not having trust in U.S. currency and U.S. bonds and U.S. government officials, that foreign governments may not have that trust in our government. So that is a risk. But from a demographic standpoint, you know, yields should definitely continue falling.
So let's just finish off where we started off. It sounds like what you're saying to me is that in a theoretical world, yes, inflation does reduce wealth inequality, but the way the financial system is set up now, that's not the case. So would the policies that you would pursue as Fed Chair Jake Merle, and I think you are tall enough for Trump, you know, if you were to be chair of the Fed.
That's a big dude.
Powell?
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, he's bigger than Janet, who I love, but wow,
just slightly.
Is there a more controversial statement to make on a Real Vision podcast than espousing love for Janet Yellen? Anyway, so it sounds like what you're saying is, if monetary conditions were more "quote unquote" normal, more resembled the monetary conditions of, let's say, the 50s in the United States, that inflation's impact on wealth inequality would be more the way it looks in the textbooks. It's just that we're in such a topsy-turvy world that inflation is actually benefiting the rich rather than the poor.
I think we live in a debt-based monetary system that needs inflation, and the rich know this, and they avoid that taxation through asset price inflation while the poor are holding the bag.
All right. Very well put. I'm not gonna agree or disagree, but it's a very interesting perspective. And you know, this thing is that this debate in a podcast booth versus on Twitter, you know, much less angry.
It's definitely more civil.
Not only more civil, but I don't need Michelle guiding me through the sidewalk so that I can pay attention to it. Okay, well, thanks for joining us this week on the Knock and Fact. Thank you so much, Jake, for sitting in here.
Yeah, enjoyed it.
And yeah, you can check out a new episode every Thursday night. Check out the video version. I think we're going to be back next week on realvision.com/knockoneffect and grab your 14-day free trial to check out that interview with Tim Draper, in addition to many others. Okay, goodbye.